probably booked well in excess of 20,000 different programs in the 25 years since we formed Kepler Speakers. But one thing that hasn't changed is our commitment to providing the right speaker for each event.
Hi, Bobby.
When that speaker comes in, we know that the people that planned it, that rely on us, know we've given them everything we have.
When I'm working with a client, I'm part of their company. I'm part of their association. I've got a vested interest in the success of the event.
Because Kepler knows their speakers and they understand what our goal is and what our audience is, they make us look very, very good.
One of the things we looked at to set ourselves apart was to identify those who are real people with real stories.
Not only are our speakers truly the most inspiring, the most motivational on the circuit, they're in some ways changing communities one speech at a time.
That you'll achieve the dreams that you want.
I think Kepler tries to connect people to speakers who will reach in and touch their hearts.
One of the greatest thrills I've ever gotten, when one of our speakers told about being stranded on Mount Everest, left there for dead, and the only inspiration that got him to come back down the mountain was the thought of seeing his family again. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. Moments like that really change lives, and that's what makes this business all worthwhile.
Hi, I'm Kelly Skibbe with Kepler Speakers. Welcome to the Kepler Speakers Power Keynote Session. Tomorrow, don't miss Kepler Speakers Power Keynote Session with Warren Brown, founder of Cake Love and host of Food Network's Sugar Rush. He'll be in this room at 10:45 a.m. His speech is Cake Love. Find your passion, follow your calling. And now to our speaker. Allison Levine is no stranger to risk-taking. She has survived sub-zero temperatures, hurricane-force winds, sudden avalanches, and a career on Wall Street. Surprisingly, Allison was born with a life-threatening heart condition that precluded most demanding physical activities. As a teenager, her health was so unstable that she was not even allowed to do such basic things as drive a car or walk up the stairs. But 13 years after her initial diagnosis, she had surgery that changed her life, and climbing stairs soon gave way to climbing mountains, a passion that Allison continued to pursue despite her initial health setbacks. Over the years, as she continued to climb the corporate ladder, Allison also pushed her limits on the world's highest peaks and soon became one of the most experienced female mountaineers in the country. She has climbed peaks on every continent, served as the team captain of the first Americans Women's Everest Expedition, and skied across the Arctic Circle to the geographic North Pole. In January 2008, she made history as the first American to follow a remote route across West Antarctica for 600 miles to the South Pole. She completed this arduous journey on skis while hauling 150 pounds of her gear and supplies in a sled harnessed to her waist. And you'll see how small she is. Her success in extreme environments is noteworthy given she suffers from a neurological disease that causes the arteries that feed her fingers and toes to collapse in cold weather, leaving her at very extreme risk for frostbite. Allison currently serves as an adjunct professor at the United States Military Academy at West Point, where she teaches in the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Leadership. She is also the president of her own consulting firm, Daredevil Strategies, and she is the founder of the Climb High Foundation. This is a nonprofit that trains jobless women in Africa to work as porters and trekking guides in their local mountains. Please join me in welcoming Allison Levine.
Hi, Seth. Hey, sister. Thanks, you guys. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me here today. You heard a little bit about my background, a little bit about some of my health challenges and some of my adventurous activities, but I'll give you a little bit about my professional background. I spent 11 years in healthcare and technology, went back to business school, got an MBA from Duke. When I finished up at Duke, I went to work for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street, and then eventually left Wall Street when I was recruited away to serve as deputy finance director for the Schwarzenegger campaign. Now, I know that when you look at this, You're wondering, what would make me want to take on this kind of challenge? And trust me, I asked myself the same question many times. And I know I had a lot of friends that were worried about me, and I had family and loved ones that were worried that I might not come back alive. But I'm here to tell you today that if you have the right attitude, the right level of determination, and you put together the right team, that it is absolutely possible to get a Republican elected in the state of California.
Oh.
So you thought I was going to turn into like cheesy motivational speaker just now, didn't you? Scared you guys. I'm not going to do that. What I want to do with you is just share with you some of the lessons I learned while climbing the world's highest peaks, because a lot of those great lessons that I learned in the mountains really helped me in the business world. And on the flip side, a lot of the great lessons I learned in the business world really helped me survive in some pretty sketchy situations up in these peaks. Now, when people ask me about my favorite mountain, I tell them about Mount McKinley. It's also called Denali. It's my favorite mountain I've ever been to, simply because I think it has the coolest views of any place I've ever been. It's also where I learned a lot of great lessons about using my resources very effectively and efficiently. Now, if someone had told me before I went to Mount McKinley that I could survive for a month with just the stuff that I was carrying in a backpack and pulling behind me in a sled, I don't think I would have believed them. But I learned that I could do that on this mountain because basically you have no choice. You only have the stuff that you can carry with you, right? So you learn to stop stressing out about things you used to have or things you wish you had or things that other people have. And you just have to figure out how to make it work with what you have with you at that time, because basically you have no choice. When people ask me about the summit ridge here, I show them this picture. This is me heading up to the summit. People ask me questions about this one all the time. They always say, Mount McKinley, it's really cold and steep. Give me some advice. So I just say, stay left. Definitely the most challenging peak I've been to is called Karsten's Pyramid. So it's in this this kind of random place called Irianjaya. So half the island is New Guinea, the other half is Irianjaya. And I went there during my fall break from grad school in 1998. And at that time, Indonesia had gone in and seized control of Irianjaya. But Irianjaya wanted independence from Indonesia. So there was all this war and craziness going on, this big separatist movement. It was a very violent movement over in Irianjaya. So I went to go get my climbing permit. And the guy that issued the permits basically just said, I'm sorry, you cannot go to Karsten's Pyramid. The whole area is shut down. And I said, what do you mean I can't go? And he said, there is war, there is fighting, it is much too dangerous. Nobody can pass through here anymore. And I said, come on, there's got to be a way for me to go. You know, I really want to climb. And he said, I'm sorry, it's impossible. And I said, impossible? You know, there's got to be a way. And he said, sure, maybe if you had, like, the Indonesian army to escort you safely. So this is me with the Indonesian army. And I got these guys to escort me safely to the base of Karsten's Pyramid and became the second American woman to climb it. But it was just one of those examples of asking the right questions, right? Because it's always going to be easier for someone to tell you no than to help you find a solution to something. So you're going to have to be the proactive one and the creative one and keep asking the questions until you get the answer that you want. And you can't just pack up your toys and go home every time somebody tells you no. When people ask me about the harshest environment I've been to, the most remote place, it's definitely the Vincent Massif or Mount Vincent. It's the highest peak in Antarctica. Antarctica is 5.5 million square miles of solid ice. So this continent is 98% ice, 2% rock. Coldest temperatures ever recorded were recorded there, 170 degrees below zero. Very harsh environment, as you can see. But I'm used to harsh environments as a single straight woman over the age of 40 living in San Francisco. Kind of a tough market. So I I always wanted to go to Antarctica because I was fascinated by the story of Ernest Shackleton. Does anyone know who he is? A couple people. Okay, so he was this really famous British explorer. Apparently not that famous. But he was this guy. He led this British trans-Antarctic expedition. They wanted to be the first guys to cross Antarctica on foot. So he recruited his team. They set off on this ship called the Endurance. What happened was their ship got caught in pack ice on the way there. And this ice moved in, and it totally crushed the ship. And Shackleton's expedition, all these team members, they had to abandon ship. And they lived on these ice floes for months. And they were gone for 20 months altogether. They were presumed dead. And Shackleton managed to get every member of his expedition back alive. He is considered one of the greatest heroes to walk this earth. And the number one goal of any expedition is always come back alive, right? Number one. Number two, come back with all your fingers and toes. Number three, come back as friends with the people that you're with. Number four, you know, have a great time along the way. And maybe goal number five is get across Antarctica or get to the South Pole or get to the top of the mountain, but it comes way down the line. Well, I was always really fascinated by this expedition, and one of the things I got such a kick out of was his recruiting ad. So this is Ernest Shackleton's recruiting ad for expedition members, right? Team wanted, hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, safe return doubtful, but honor and recognition in case of success. And I am thinking, who in their right mind is going to answer an ad like this? All right. Okay, so the American Women's Everest Expedition. This is a climb where I learned more great lessons about business and about life than just about any other experience I'd had. And this is a climb that took place in 2002. And in 2001, I got a phone call asking me if I wanted to serve as the team captain for this trip. And initially when I got the phone call, I said no, because even though I'd climbed the highest peak on six continents and done a lot of other climbing in between, I still really felt like, I wasn't good enough and I wasn't experienced enough, and it just felt like more challenge than what I was ready to take on. But then came September 11th, and that really changed the way that so many of us look to the future. And for me, one of the messages that came out of that was to not let fear stop you from doing the things that you want to do. So I ended up calling these women back and agreeing to serve as the team captain. And at that time, I still really didn't know if I had what it was going to take to get up that mountain. But I knew if I didn't step up to the plate and try, that I would never find out. And I actually ran across this quote when I was contemplating the whole thing, and it's a quote by the first woman who ever climbed Mount Everest, Junko Taibe. She's from Japan. And she reminds us that it's not just about technique and ability, it's about willpower. And that's really the most important thing. So I knew for sure that I had willpower. But one thing I knew for sure I didn't have was money. I was about $70,000 in debt thanks to all of my student loans from grad school, and nobody else I knew who was a climber had any money. So we had to go out and raise the funds for this expedition. And I ended up connecting with a friend of mine from my MBA program who worked in the Mercury division of Ford in Southern California. And he helped us funnel the idea of the first American Women's Everest Expedition up to the senior people in Michigan for Ford. And they really liked the idea of sponsoring us because it just so happened that our expedition coincided with the launch of their new full-size SUV, the Ford Expedition, right? So it was our expedition in conjunction with their expedition, and it was this match made in heaven. And I was so happy that things worked out well with Ford because I was also negotiating with Chevy at the time, and their full-size SUV is the Avalanche. So call me crazy, but I'm just thinking that if you're going to go to Everest, you want to be sponsored by the expedition and probably not by the Avalanche. So it worked out well. Next thing I had to do was pull together the team, and this was a very interesting process because at first I was just super fired up about women that had a ton of climbing experience, but you figure out very quickly that it doesn't do you any good to be high up on Mount Everest or any other mountain in the world with the best climbers if they don't care about the team. And on the flip side, you can't be up there with people who are really fun and cool and easy to get along with if they don't have the skills to be successful in that kind of environment. Recruiting mistakes are very costly, and you can't afford to make them when you go to these peaks. So you've got to find people with the perfect mix of skill and experience, but who are also going to be good team players. And I can honestly say, if I had to pick another team again, I would pick the exact same women. This is just a shot of us at the New York Auto Show. Ford took us there shortly before we left for Nepal. So that's us with the new 2003 Ford Expedition. It's the only full-size SUV with independent rear suspension and optional third-row power-fold seats. Gotta plug the sponsor. Okay, so I had the team, I had the funding, I had a 2-month unpaid leave of absence from work, and then all of a sudden I am thinking, holy crap, we're really going. And I started to get completely freaked out and intimidated, because the thought of going from sea level to 29,000 feet above sea level just absolutely made my head spin. So the only way I could really wrap my brain around what we had to do was to break it down into much smaller steps. So when you have some goal that just feels completely overwhelming, I guarantee it's easier to attack it in smaller bits. So instead of stressing out about how we were going to go to 29,000 feet, I just thought, all right, what has to happen to get the team to base camp? That's all I want to do. Let's just get this team to base camp. Once we're at base camp, that's when I started thinking, okay, what has to happen? Oops, why does it do that? To get the team to camp one. Once we're at camp one, that's when I started thinking about what we're going to do to get the team to camp two. Now, the interesting thing is that you don't just climb from base camp to camp one to camp two and so on, right? You have to move up this mountain really slowly, but what you do is you go to base camp, you spend a few nights at base camp, you climb up to camp one and spend the night, and the next day you come back down to base camp. Spend a few nights at base camp again, climb up to camp one and spend the night, climb up to camp two and spend the night. Next day, back to base camp again. Spend a few nights at base camp, go to camp one, next day you go to camp two, next day all the way up there to camp three, and the next day, all the way back down to base camp. Now, the reason you have to keep doing that is you have to let your body get used to the altitude very slowly. It's this process called acclimatization. Now, if someone were to magically drop you off on the summit of Mount Everest, if you could be dropped there by, you know, a plane or a helicopter or something like that, you'd be dead in a matter of minutes from the altitude. So you want to move up really gradually so your head doesn't pop off when you get to the top. It doesn't really pop off, but, you know. Anyway. So you want to move up slowly to get used to the altitude. But the crazy catch-22 is that once you're above 18,000 feet, which is any camp above base camp, once you're above 18,000 feet, your muscles are starting to deteriorate and your body's getting weaker. So it's hard because you want to spend time up high to get used to the altitude, but you want to keep coming back down low just to regain some strength and let your muscles rest. And you come back down low so you can eat, sleep, hydrate, regain your strength. So not only is it very physically challenging to keep going like this, but psychologically it's very challenging as well, because intellectually you know you want to be heading in this direction, right? But you're spending a heck of a lot of time climbing this way. But what you have to remember is that even though you are going backwards, you're still making progress because you're helping your body go through that acclimatization process. And for some reason, we always think that progress has to be in one particular direction. But it doesn't. Progress can be in a lot of different directions. So don't ever get freaked out if you feel like you're going backwards, because sometimes you have to take a few steps backwards in order to eventually get to where you want to be. This is just a shot of base camp on Mount Everest. If you saw the movie Vertical Limit, it is nothing like that. There are no keg parties or bonfires or s'mores. It's basically just some rocks and some tents. All right, the first part of the route once you leave base camp is this area called the Khumbu Icefall. Khumbu Icefall is where most of the accidents occur on this mountain. Khumbu Icefall is basically 2,000 vertical feet of these big, huge, moving ice chunks. These ice chunks are the size of school buses or apartment buildings. You can get an idea of the scale when you look at those two little people up there in the middle. This ice ball is in constant motion, and it moves at a rate of 4 feet per day. And what happens is the sun comes up and everything starts to melt, and these big, huge ice chunks start to shift around. So you are in constant danger of being crushed. Now, it's made more complicated by the fact that there are these big, huge open crevasses everywhere where you could fall hundreds of feet to your death. So they span these rickety aluminum ladders across them so you can get from one side to the other without falling in. So between the big, huge moving ice chunks and the open crevasses, it is a very scary part of the mountain. But it's also where I learned one of the best lessons about business and about life, which is this. Fear is okay. Fear is okay. It's just a normal human emotion. Complacency is what will kill you. Complacency is what absolutely puts you at risk. You do not ever stand still when you're going through this ice fall. You are constantly moving. You hydrate while you're climbing through. You eat while you're climbing. You don't ever sit around and do nothing. Because when you're doing nothing and you're not reacting to the environment around you, that's really what really puts you at risk here. So you want to constantly be moving. So I think fear is actually a good thing. I think it's a great tool. I think that it keeps you sort of awake and aware of what's going on around you. Don't ever beat yourself up for feeling scared or feeling intimidated. But complacency, can't afford to be that way. Couple more shots of the team going through the ice fall. These are the boots that we wear once we leave base camp. They cost about $650. But if you break it down, it's only $65 a toe. So if you want to keep all of yours, you suck it up and buy the boots. This is just a shot of Camp 1 on the other side of the ice fall. Here's the team at Camp 2. I'm 5'4". I was the tallest person on the team. Lynn on the far right, 4'9". Midge in the middle is 5'2". Jody's 5'3". We were so short that we could not even fit into size extra small down suits that you would get from the North Face or Marmot or Mountain Hardware or something like that. So we actually had to have these custom made. But we liked them because we thought they were kind of flattering. So one question I know people always have, and it never fails, because I do these talks all the time, and I go to leave, and somebody always runs out of the room after me, and they go, "Allison, I just have this one question, but I'm not sure if I should ask it, because it's kind of embarrassing." And I always know what the question is. It's that question about, how do you go to the bathroom up there? Because people see these pictures, right, and we're in these big, huge down suits, and you've got on 6 layers of clothing, and, you know, you're wearing some safety harness strapped into a, you know, an anchor and some really steep slope, and it's a gazillion degrees below zero. As a woman trying to get out of all of those layers and drop trow and squat and balance, it's really difficult, and it's also actually a little dangerous. So we came up with a solution to that, which I will demonstrate. I mean, I'm not going to demonstrate, but just going to share it with you. Like the front row's all nervous. Okay, I'm just gonna share it with you because I know people wonder. So this is just what we call the pee funnel. And this allows women to urinate standing up. So we don't have to, right? We don't have to go through that whole rigmarole anymore. And we can write our name in the snow. Okay, and just between us girls, best thing about this device is that even in freezing cold temperatures, it stays this long. going. Little funnel envy, I think. All right, so now you know. That's the answer. You don't have to wonder anymore. All right, moving right along. Building relationships, forming partnerships. This is one of the most important parts of successful climbing. And it's also one of the most overlooked. So first thing I do when I get to base camp on any mountain, I walk around, I talk to every other team that's there. And people make fun of me all the time. They always say, oh, Allison, you're so social. And it's not about being social, okay? It's about the fact that, God forbid, something should happen to one of my teams high up on one of these peaks. I want the people around us to feel obligated to help us. And the only way that's going to happen is if you have these relationships in place with other teams. And I think that far too often the mistake that is made is that people think that just because their team's working really well together, that that's all they need to worry about. But you have to think about who outside of your team you might need to call on for help at some point. And you need to have those relationships in place ahead of time before you really need them. And every year, I hear a story about some climber struggling to survive high up on Mount Everest, and you hear these stories about other teams that walk right past this person because they don't want to give up their summit attempt in order to help save a life. And it's tragic that that should happen. It should never happen, but unfortunately it does. But I guarantee you, if you have relationships in place with other teams, they're not going to walk past you in your time of need. But it's up to you to be proactive and put these relationships in place. All right, the mountain you see right here is called Lhotse. It's another 8,000-meter peak. It's right next to Mount Everest. And the way you climb Mount Everest is you actually climb about two-thirds of the way up that face, hang a hard left, and that's what takes you over to the route on Mount Everest. So you're up on that Lhotse face at about 24,000 feet. You're not even on Mount Everest yet. When people ask me about the toughest part of this climb, I tell them a story about this gentleman here. His name was Peter Legat. He was part of a British expedition that was climbing a day ahead of us. So we talked about how you go up and down, right, up higher and down. So he was coming down that Lhotse face that you just saw as we were getting ready to head up. This guy slipped and fell 1,500 feet down that face, and his body was in pieces at the bottom. I mean, literally in pieces. And his climbing partners ran to our camp for help, just because we were the closest camp to where this accident occurred. But there was nothing anybody could do at that point for him. And that incident really shattered our team, because at that moment we realized this mountain is a lot bigger and tougher than we are. And sometimes no matter how good you are and no matter how prepared you are, things can still go wrong. And tragedy is going to do one of two things to a team. It's either going to blow it up or it's going to make everybody pull together. And I wasn't sure which way this was going to go for us, because we took a day off from climbing and we talked about it and we started thinking about Peter and his loved ones and our loved ones back home. And we eventually went back to that initial message about not letting fear stop you from doing the things that you want to do. So even though we were really scared and nervous at that point, I was super proud of the team because everybody saddled up to head right back up that Lhotse face. There are always going to be risks. Risks in life, risks in business. You just have to be really smart about the ones that you're willing to take, right? And you do everything you can to mitigate those risks. Here's a few more shots of the team heading up Lhotse. All right, I put this picture in because it's a totally fake smile. And I had actually puked all over right before they took that shot. But I put it in because it's a reminder that even when you feel like absolute crap, when you're in a leadership position, you put a smile on your face and you get out there and you do your job, because that is what you are supposed to do. And I feel like every single person in every single organization is in a leadership position. You do not have to be, you know, a CEO, a CFO, part of the executive staff, because everything that people do within a company affects somebody else. So everybody has to sort of walk the walk and talk the talk and think of themselves as a leader. And when you're on one of these trips, if something happens to your team leader, the rest of the people have to be ready to step up and lead, right? So you can't just think of leadership as the job of the most senior people. So 24,000 feet on the Lhotse face, everybody felt sick from the altitude, right? Everybody had banging headaches, was sick to their stomach. We went back down to base camp, right? Because doing this. Got back down to base camp, and all we did is gripe and complain about how miserable it was up there at that camp. But the bottom line is that we had to go back up there again a few more times. So sometimes you know that you are going to be heading into a very uncomfortable environment. Suck it up, put a smile on your face, get out there and do what you're supposed to do. You basically have no choice. So the next time we went back up there, it was still miserable. But instead of complaining about how awful it was, I said, hey, you guys, check out the view. This is pretty cool. And somebody else chimed in. Hey, you know what? This is an altitude record for every person on the team. And somebody else chimed in and went, hey, we only have one more camp after this one before we go to the summit. And all of a sudden, everybody was talking about how cool it was. So if you can be the person to put the smile on your face during a very uncomfortable situation, people around you will really appreciate that because that enthusiasm really is contagious. Excuse me. I just need a cigarette. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry. Oh, sorry. All right. Dealing with change. This is just what you get when you go to the mountains. It's what you expect. Things are always, always changing. And it's all the stuff that you have absolutely zero control over. So the weather's a big factor, right? The weather's always changing. That's kind of an obvious one. But there are other factors, too, that you can't control. Your health, the health of your team, the conditions of the route, you know, things that other teams are doing, the conditions of your gear. There are all these things that are going to affect your climb. No control over any of those things. So you just have to deal. So sometimes you look up at the summit of Mount Everest and it looks like this and it looks like it might be, you know, pretty approachable. But within a matter of minutes, everything can change and it can look like that. And that's pretty intimidating. But one thing you know about these storms is that they're always temporary. Storms are always temporary. There's just no such thing as the storm that lasts forever. Right, so you know that when you're in the middle of something like this, you just have to keep your bearings and wait it out because at some point, clouds are going to clear, blue sky is going to be there again, and everything's going to be okay. So you just kind of expect that there's going to be some times like this. All right, here is a shot of the team heading up to the high camp. This is me at the high camp. You are more than welcome to borrow this picture and tell people it's you. Nobody will ever know. All right, so the high camp. High camp's at 26,000 feet. It's also known as the death zone. And they call it the death zone because at 26,000 feet, your body is literally starting to die. And it starts to pull all the blood right here in your core. And it pulls all the blood out of your fingers and toes. It pulls out of your hands and your feet. And it just starts to concentrate on your vital organs. So all the blood gets pooled right here. Because you can live without your fingers and toes and your hands and your feet, but you can't live without these vital organs. So the human body is amazing the way it works that way. It just focuses everything on heart, lungs, brain, and keeping those things alive. So you're constantly, you know, wiggling your hands and your feet and your fingers and toes to make sure you don't get frostbite. At this elevation, you're taking about 5 to 10 breaths for every step. 5 to 10 breaths for every step. Looks like this. Take a step and then you go. Five to ten times before you do this. Take another step. 5 to 10 breaths again before you do this. Okay, so if you ever think you're having a slow day, could be so much worse. So, we get up here to the high camp, lay down for a couple of hours just to sort of rest our muscles and our bones. We got up out of our tents about 10:30 at night to head to the summit. 10:30 at night, pitch dark, freezing cold, can't see anything, so you wear a headlamp, it's like a little flashlight, you wear it on your head, and I get out of my tent, And I start thinking, okay, I'm at 26,000 feet. I need to be at 29,035 feet. That's over 3,000 vertical feet. And I start doing the math, right? I start going one step, 5 to 10 breaths, 3,000 vertical feet. And I start to get completely freaked out and intimidated again. Feel sick to my stomach about how we're going to do this. So, again, back to that strategy. Break it down into smaller steps. And I just took my headlamp and I shined it on this rock that was down the trail. And I thought, okay, I just need to make it to that rock. That's all I want to do. Just need to make it to the rock. And I stared at the rock, took my step, 5 to 10 breaths, right? Step, 5 to 10 breaths. Before I knew it, made it to the rock. Once I got to the rock, I did the same thing. Took my headlamp and I shined it on this piece of ice that was sticking out down the trail. And I thought, all right, just to that piece of ice, it's where I'm going. I just need to make it to the piece of ice. And I did the same thing. One step, 5 to 10 breaths, and I made it to the piece of ice. So every time I kept thinking, I don't know if I can keep going. I think this might be it. I thought, well, I didn't think I could make it to the last landmark, and I made it to that one. So maybe I could just do one more. Okay, maybe I can make it to one more, right? So we climbed through the whole entire night like that. By 6:30 in the morning, we were at this place called the South Summit, which is just below the true summit of Mount Everest. And at that point, a couple of interesting things happened. First is that my oxygen tank malfunctioned at 28,750 feet above sea level. That is not where you want to have your oxygen tank go out. I mean, jet planes fly up that high. And I knew I was getting really cold and I was getting slower and I was feeling a little disoriented. And I thought I had this condition called cerebral edema, which is swelling from the brain. It's caused by altitude. And the thing is, if you think you have cerebral edema, you don't have it. Because if your brain is swollen to the point where you're about to die, you're basically just laying on the ground foaming at the mouth and you're not tapping your teammates going, hey, I think I've got a little touch of cerebral edema. Could you? So luckily it was just a case of a malfunction in one of the valves on my oxygen tank, and I had been climbing without oxygen for about 45 minutes, and that's why I was feeling cold and slow and really disoriented. But luckily we were able to fix the problem in about 20 minutes. But that was kind of a scary period of time for me, because if something happens to you that high up on the mountain, there's a good chance you might not be coming back, because it is very difficult to orchestrate a rescue that high up. At that elevation, it's pretty much all anybody can do to just put one foot in front of the other. And that's why you see frozen corpses up there that have been up there for years and years, because nobody even has the strength to move them off the trail. So the other crazy thing that happened shortly thereafter is that storm clouds started to come in. So at that point, we had to make a very tough call. So this... why do I keep doing that? I don't know how that's working. That is the summit of Mount Everest, right there. That is where we turned around to go down. Trust me when I tell you that turning around and walking away from the deal is harder than continuing on. But when you're up there on these peaks, you have to be able to make very tough decisions when the conditions around you are far from perfect. And you have to think about how every single move you make is going to affect everybody else around you and not just you. And it doesn't matter how much blood, sweat, and tears you put into something. If it's not the right thing, you turn around and walk away. Mount Everest is just a pile of rock and ice. It's really all it is. You can always go back. But if you do something dumb up there, you may not have an opportunity to go back. Gosh, look at all the sad faces. And just so you guys know, that distance, it's around 200 feet. That would take us 2 to 3 hours. Because I feel like you're looking at me and you're looking at this and you're like, I don't get it. Like, why didn't you just run, touch the top, run back? You know, and you can't run up there. You guys are taking a 10 breaths for every step. So couple of hours worth of climbing, and we didn't feel like we had a safe weather window. So at that point, we turned around to come down, and it's a good thing that we did because we did get caught in the storm. We lost all our visibility. We had to spend the night at 26,000 feet in the death zone, and that's not where you want to spend the night. You want to get out of the death zone down to a lower, safer elevation, but we lost visibility. We couldn't see. We spent kind of a scary night just huddled together in one tent trying to not get blown off the mountain. You can see what storms do to tents at that elevation. It just destroys entire camps. We got a little bit of a break the next day. We were able to start heading down to a lower, safer elevation. But what you have to remember is that even though you're coming down the mountain, your climb is not over until you walk in the front door of your house. And it's really easy to think that just because you're coming down the mountain that there's no more risk, right? The terrain's a lot easier to navigate and you're feeling a lot stronger. It's easier to breathe down at the lower elevation. But as long as you are anywhere on this mountain, there is always risk. So the Khumbu Icefall, that area with all the big, huge moving ice chunks, we'd gone through that thing 7 times with no problem. 8th time, completely different story. So Jody and I were out in front, and the rest of the team was just a few minutes behind us. And all of a sudden, we heard this sound, like a big moving freight train or something. And we turned around only to see 10,000 tons of ice. This huge, massive ice wall was coming crashing down. And we thought for sure we were going to be crushed, right? So we're completely freaking out. We're trying to figure out how to get out of the way. But you can't run in that ice fall because there are all those open crevasses everywhere with those ladders. So we thought for sure we were going to be killed. And there was this this video guy there from National Geographic, and he was just a few feet away from us, and he looked at us, and he saw us panicking, and he yelled over to us. He yelled, "Whoa, whoa, 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 don't move, stay where you are, stay right where you are." So Jody and I just kind of grabbed each other, and we're, you know, shaking and crying and hyperventilating. And the whole ice crumble came to a stop about 4 feet from us. That's how close we were to getting killed. It was really scary. Like clean up on aisle 4 kind of scary. So we're just a complete wreck, right? And I look over at the video guy and I said, "Oh my gosh, you know, how did you stay so calm?" And he said, "Oh, I knew it was going to be okay." And I'm thinking, how could he know that, right? Because he was right there with us and he almost got killed too. And about a month later, I was laughing my head off because I read this article that he wrote about the day the Khumbu Icefall collapsed, and it was kind of a big deal. No one had ever seen anything that dramatic happen in the ice fall before. So he wrote this article and he described the whole sequence of events. And he wrote, "Jody and Allison panicked and looked for somewhere to run, but I urged them to remain calm because I knew for sure we were all going to die." There was nothing anybody could do about it. So it was just funny because that day he was all, "Yeah, I knew it was going to be okay." You know, and then when he wrote the article, he basically said, "I knew we were all toast and panicking was not going to save us." So it was crazy. All right, you guys, I've got one last mountain story to share with you. And this is my very favorite story. So this one takes place in some mountains called the Ruwenzori Mountains. And the Ruwenzori Mountains border Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Sketchy. So these mountains, there's been war between those countries for decades, right? And those mountains were used as a staging area for the rebels from the Congo to come in and invade Uganda. So they shut off access to these mountains for a while to prevent these rebels from getting into Uganda. Well, the unfortunate thing about shutting off access to the Ruwenzori Mountains is that working in the mountains as a trekking guide or a porter or a high-altitude cook is the only source of income for people in western Uganda. It's the Bakanjo people, the Bakanjo tribes there. And so the Bakanjos work in these mountains. They shut off the mountains. These people have no way to earn a living. They're basically starving to get to death. And the Red Cross was going in and just dropping off food supplies for them. But they signed a peace treaty. I believe it was in 2002. And in 2003, they opened up access to the Ruwenzori Mountains again. And I went there in 2005 to climb because I heard that these were some of the most beautiful peaks in the world. When I went there, the first thing that I noticed when I was walking around the village at the base of the mountain was that women there were doing all of the physical labor. They were out in the farmland, you know, out in the fields farming, and they were walking around town carrying big jugs of water on their head and big, you know, piles of potatoes and food and supplies, and they just looked really strong because they were working so hard. So I went to the permit office to get a permit and to hire a guide and local porters to go with me because, again, it's park regulations state that you have to hire the locals to go with you as guides and porters. Again, it's the only way to feed the economy there. So I went to get my guide and my porters, and I said, hey, by the way, could I get women guides and porters just because the women looked so strong to me? And the guy looked at me like I was from another planet, and he said, I'm sorry, there are no women guides and porters in the Ruwenzori Mountains. Amongst the Bokanjo people, women are not allowed to go to the mountains. And I said, you're kidding. Well, if they can't go to the mountains, how do they earn money? And he said, women cannot earn money. They're owned by men. And I was like, what are you talking about? So I come to find out that in this area, amongst the Bokanjo tribe, women are actually considered property of men. They have no rights. They aren't allowed to own land or homes. They have no access to medical care or education. And as a result, the average life expectancy is only 42. This sounded like kind of a raw deal to me. So I started asking people, why is that? Why can't women go to the mountains and earn money? And people just started saying, because we have always been told that, because it is taboo. Because we've been told this by our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents. And I said, okay, I get that, but what was the reason? Like, what was the reason they gave you for why women couldn't go to the mountains? And nobody knew. They just kept saying, well, we've always been told that. So I thought, well, maybe it's time for that little tradition to change. And I ended up calling a meeting with the head of the park service, the head of the mountain guiding service, and the head of the local village. And I said, here's the deal, you guys. If you let me recruit your local women and take them up into these mountains, I will train them to work as porters and trekking guides in the Ruwenzori Mountains. And if they can make it, if they can, you know, handle these jobs and climb the mountain, then you have to hire them and pay them the same wage that you pay the local men. And the men were absolutely supportive, and they were really rational in the way they approached it. And they said, you know what? We agree with you. Like, we see the benefit in that. Because they understood that if the women are working and there's more capital flowing into the community, that maybe children would then have money for medical care and for education and things that they didn't have money for before. And I said, you know, more capital flowing in here, they got the benefit of that. They said, we see that that could be a good thing. The problem is, women cannot climb mountains because they're just too weak. And I was like, okay. Here's the deal. Like, I'm going to take some of these women up, and if they can climb it, you're going to hire them and pay them the same wage. And they said, well, you can try, but the problem is they're never going to make it. So I've got a quick 5-minute video, if we could roll that. I'll show you what happened when we went up there.
Traditionally, it was believed, we were even being told by our grandparents that women are not supposed to come this way.
It was a taboo for women to go up the mountains.
Ah.
Anything beyond the kitchen and that, it is not a domain.
We look at women as weak people.
Women, in most cases, don't do what men do. They can't do what? They can't do that kind of work?
There is no business which we can earn. We have to struggle for life.
A huge reason why we're here is to try to make a difference for the local women in the Ruwenzori Mountain areas. It's been a very tumultuous area, a lot of civil war. The region's just been devastated. Women's lack of access to capital has led to poverty and social injustice. So we came up with the idea of training them to be porters and trekking guides in their local mountains. By establishing themselves in that industry, they may have a shot at becoming financially independent and having a decent quality of life in the future. We stopped by Ruwenzori Mountaineering Service headquarters to tell them that we wanted to go trekking and that we wanted to hire women porters. We showed up and we were surprised by the big group of the women who were incredibly enthusiastic about doing this climb with us.
All these women you've seen, they want to go with you, but they have no chance to.
There are others who are
a bit weak. Those were a bit weak.
So we let the weak ones try. Every woman who came here for a job today, okay, we want to hire.
Okay.
I want to take as many as want to come. However many want to come, that's how many I want to take.
Okay.
The Ruwenzori Central Circuit is a very challenging trek. It's steep climbing and big mud bog and ladders and big tree roots that you're climbing over, and it goes up to over 14,000 feet. The fact that these women had never climbed it before and they were able to strap 12 kilograms on their back and complete the trekking circuit with a smile on their face was just amazing. Summit Day was pretty interesting because the whole environment really changed. It's pretty much just rock and ice. So all of a sudden you remember, hey, we're up on a high mountain, we're up here at altitude. A lot of things could go wrong. It's not any lush green trip anymore. It's cold, it's stark. You have to watch every step. It was just a lot of rock, snow, and ice on Summit Day, and that's the stuff I love.
Yay!
Malabina, your first time!
Yeah, I hope so!
Having Malabina there really made me think about how cool of an experience the whole thing was. I mean, it was her first time to the summit, and it was very symbolic of the progress that women are making in general.
Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Oh, yes! Oh, yes!
They are very happy to come with that lady, Alice. Because the ladies are not supposed to come here, that's why they are very happy. They are really excited. That's why they are dancing.
That team of women showed an entire village that women can do anything that they want to do. They can do anything that men can do. They can break through traditional barriers that have been hard to cross in the past.
In our history, in our culture, women are not supposed to come to the mountain. But since they have started coming, we have proved there is no problem. A lady can come to the mountain because of us. You are the one who have discovered it.
If you had not come to
thanks,
ask for
you
women,
you
couldn't
thank
have
you.
Got to that fast. But
thanks.
Since you have come, things are changing. They are respectful now. They respect us more.
When we got down from the mountains and we were coming back into town, people were coming out of their huts and they were cheering for them and they were clapping. I felt like I was watching a Super Bowl team after they won the championship game and they were back in their hometown during the parade. They were just so strong and so proud. It was such a difference in their personality from the beginning before they started the trek, and then at the end of the trek when they were like, yeah, I did it.
It is now Ruwenzori becoming the mountains of the ladies. And I think for the next time, you will bring more ladies than these. You are going to bring more ladies, no men. Yeah.
I'm very grateful to stand here and say a word of thanks to you. Even the male support staff say thank you very much for the work you have done.
Oh, thanks, you guys. Thank you. Thanks. Thanks. I am happy to report that women are now regularly employed as porters and trekking guides. Thanks. Women are now employed as porters and trekking guides. They're earning the same wage that men are earning. And I actually started a nonprofit to help them, and I go back every year and train more and more women to work in these jobs. So that's Malabina. She was the first local woman to go to the top of Uganda's highest peak. And it was funny. She didn't even know what that sign meant. I'm like, here, hold this. But the big takeaway for me from this experience is ask the question. right? Because it really wasn't that hard to go in there and change things for this community. It just took somebody to ask the question, and I was shocked that nobody had ever asked it before. So sometimes it's not that hard to really be an architect of change. It just comes from asking a couple of questions. All right, so I have one last slide for you guys. It's this one here. If I had to sum up all of the lessons I've learned in all of the mountains I've ever been to, if I had to sum them up in one slide, this would be it. This is pretty much the image that's permanently ingrained in my mind. And that triangular shadow that you see there, that is the shadow of the summit of Mount Everest. And we snapped this picture shortly before we started to descend during our failed summit attempt. And to me, this image is just a reminder that there are always going to be more mountains to climb. And the thing about the mountains is the mountains don't care, you know, what your name is or where you were raised or how much money you made or what your parents do. And the mountains don't care what you did last week or last month or last year. It's all about what are you doing now. And you have to be willing to get out there and push yourself on these peaks. And you have to have the game on attitude all the time, because sometimes things are going to go your way and sometimes things are not going to go your way. But you have to be willing to put yourself out there and weather the storms if you are ever going to have an opportunity to enjoy this kind of view. Thank you so much for coming today, you guys. Thanks. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. And I think we've got a couple minutes for questions, if anybody has any. Nothing's, you know, off limits or too personal. I shared my pee funnel with you. So. Yeah. The question is, how many days does it take from start to finish to do the climb? It takes about 2 months, because it's about, you know, 8 days to walk into base camp, then you spend time acclimatizing there, and then you're going up and down. So about 2 months. Yeah. I was kidding about the cigarette. Yeah. Talk a little bit about our Antarctica trip. Okay, so I finished that about in January of 2008, and I had always really admired Reinhold Messner, he's this really famous Italian explorer, and he did this same route 20 years ago, and I read this book he wrote called Antarctica, Heaven and Hell. And so I'd always been reading stories about him, and I always admired him. And then one day the light bulb went off, and it was just this thought about, you know, instead of just reading about this, you know, if there are things that sound interesting or exciting to me, instead of just reading about them, I should get out and do them. And I thought, I've read so many stories about Reinhold's, you know, ski across Antarctica. I should get out there and try to do it and really see what it was like to walk a mile in his shoes or walk 600 miles in his shoes. And so that's kind of what prompted me to want to do it. It was very tough, just because it was very different than climbing a mountain. There's no change of scenery, and that's what's difficult. And there's stories about the early Antarctic explorers that got this condition called like polar madness, where they went crazy and they killed each other. There was cannibalism because there's just no visual stimulation. You look around, and if it's cloudy at all, it's just white everywhere around you. You can't delineate between the sky and the ground, and it's just everything's white, and there's nothing to look at, and you can't look back and go, oh, look how far we've come. You can't look ahead and say, oh, we're just going to there. There's just nothing to look at, and so that's what made that really challenging, and just the drudgery of 10 hours a day, you know, on skis, hauling that sled, and just knowing you're going to keep going every day, and there's nothing really to, you know, keep your attention on anything. So you just have to figure out how to keep your brain busy with no other stimulation. Yeah, in the black sweater. What's my next adventure? Well, I just started teaching at the United States Military Academy at West Point in January. So that's one for me, because I've never been in an academic environment before or anywhere where people are like, ma'am, sir, you know, it's very formal. But in September, I'm going to be leading a trek of HIV-positive African women up Mount Kilimanjaro. So that's kind of my next. Thanks, you guys. Yeah. So the question is, how much training do you need? Ideally, I think an ideal amount of training would be, you know, if you've been doing some climbing for a while, I would say, you know, 3 to 4 months. The problem is, I live in San Francisco. There aren't mountains very close. And I was working full time at Goldman Sachs right before I left. And so I'm in my office from 5 o'clock in the morning until 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And then I would go home and I was trying to fundraise for this trip because Ford didn't come through until 2 months beforehand. And so I was really only free, like my only free time to train was between midnight and 4 a.m. because I'm at my desk by 5. So I would, at the beginning, I would try, you know, I was thinking, okay, I have between midnight and 4. I need to train and I need to sleep. And so I found this gym that was open 24 hours. And I would go to this gym and I would convince myself, like I'd find cardio equipment I could do with my eyes closed. And I'd convince myself that I was sleeping and working out at the same time. Which, of course, you're not doing either one very effectively. And that wasn't work because I was just so exhausted. I was breaking down at work all the time and crying from exhaustion. And I'd be in the ladies' room crying and people would come in and say, "What's wrong?" And I would say, "I'm just really freaking tired." And they'd be like, "I know, we're all tired." You know, so so I'm like, that's clearly not going to work. So then I just basically reserved my weekends for training, and I would drive 6 hours from my house to Mount Shasta, which is just below the Oregon border, and I would start climbing Saturday about 11 p.m., and I'd climb through the whole night from the parking lot to the top. It's over 14,000 feet and back down. It'd take me 12 or 14 hours, and that way I was missing Saturday night of sleep, but I was only missing one night of sleep versus, you know, not getting sleep at all during the week. So that was basically my training. Yeah, in the back corner. So the question is, what do you do for food when you're gone for 2 months? So you have a huge stash of food at base camp. And what you do is, as you're going up and down, you're taking food supplies with you and you're kind of ferrying food up and leaving more supplies up there. Once you get higher on the mountain, you want to keep everything really simple because you want to conserve all of your energy. Like trying to cook a big meal uses a lot of your own energy. And so we just eat MREs up there. Those are the military meals, meal ready to eat, where you just basically boil it and eat it. So you're taking food up every time you're going up and down. But most of the food is stored at base camp because that's where you really spend the majority of your time. Yeah. South Summit, yeah. So the question was, did anyone disagree with not going forward when we got to the South Summit? So I was really worried about that because you can't really have a conversation up there. It's really loud. It's really windy. You've got all these layers on over your ears, over your head. You've got an oxygen mask on. It hurts to talk. And so you can't really have a big conversation up there. And I was very worried when we got down that people were going to be upset. And it's hard because when you're in a leadership position, you have to be able to make the tough calls and you can't really worry about people's emotions all the time. But the reality is that I do worry about people's emotions, just who I am. And you can't stop being who you are just because you're in a new position or something like that. And so I was super worried about it. And I was just relieved when we got back down to the lower camp and people started saying, "Thank God we turned around, you know, but I was so scared up there," and blah, 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 you know. And I think, you know, the thing is, at the time you think you made the right call, but you get down and the reality is you are pretty disappointed, right? And then there's always times like where I'll be out at a cocktail party in San Francisco and someone will introduce me and say, "This is my friend Allison. She climbed Mount Everest." And the guy's like, "All the way to the top?" And then you have to go, "Well, we actually turned around about, you know, 200 feet from the top." "Oh, so you didn't climb Mount Everest." So then you're like, "Well, no, we were, you know, just the spitting distance from the top." Well, if you didn't get all the way to the top, if you weren't at the very top, then it doesn't count. You didn't climb it. And I go, "Well, I was on that mountain for 2 months. What was I doing if I wasn't climbing it? Like, how would you describe what I did when I was walking up the hill with my ice axe if I wasn't climbing the mountain?" He goes, "It just doesn't count unless you were at the very top." I'm like, "Okay, you know, what do you do, tough guy?" And he's like, the guy goes, "I work for J.P. Morgan." And I said, "Oh, my gosh, no way. You're the CEO of J.P. Morgan?" And he said, "I'm not the CEO. I work in fixed income trading." I'm like, "Well, then, guess you don't really work for J.P. Morgan then, do you?" So
Like, occasionally you get to, like, you know. But I think if I had another 2 months off and a big spot, so I'd want to do something else and have a totally different experience. But, like, occasionally you get the, you know, people kind of ribbing you about it. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, what am I planning to do beyond West Point? Do I have a website? Am I planning to write a book or anything? I don't have a book yet, but I would like to write one. I've just been basically too lazy. There's no other... That's true. There's no other way around to describe why I don't have a book. Is I've just been too lazy. So I still run my nonprofit where I go back to Uganda to help these women there, and then I'm starting to work with another organization that is trying to fight AIDS in Africa. So between the West Point thing, and then I do a lot of this speaking too, so don't forget that. So I do. Between all those things, it keeps me pretty busy for now. But you know, it's funny. I don't tend to plan too far about what's down the road or what's on the horizon. Things just kind of pop into my head, and then all of a sudden they happen. So like the West Point thing just happened in December, and it was because I actually decided I wanted to enlist in the Army. And I found out I was too old, and because the age limit's 42, and I'm 42. I don't turn 43 until April, and they were like, you have to enlist before your 43rd birthday. And I'm like, you know, where in your recruiting literature does it state that I, you know, you have to enlist before? And I'm like, how can I get around this? How can I fight this? How can I? And so I ended up calling this a guy I knew who was a colonel. He teaches in the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Leadership in West Point, And I said, Colonel Colditz, like, I am absolutely gutted. I'm trying to enlist in the Army, and they will not take me because I'm too old, and I really want to serve my country, and, like, this whole thing. And I said, is there any way around this? And, again, going back, ask the question, right? You don't just accept things and walk away. Ask the question. How can I get around this? Is there any way to get an exemption? Is there someone I can talk to? Is there someone you can talk to? How do we fix this? And he just said, Allison, if you want to do something to help the Army, come teach a class in my department at West Point. And so that's kind of, it was just a quick thing. It literally, like, we started the discussions in December, and I went out there for the first time to teach in January. So things just kind of pop up, and I don't tend to really plan down the road very much, which isn't necessarily a good thing. Anything else? Yeah. So the question is, besides all the necessities, is there anything that I took with me? So the hard part is, you have to carry everything with you. And so you tend to get rid of things that are not completely necessary. I mean, we would break off our toothbrushes to just have the bristles, so we didn't have to carry the handle. I mean, you know, cut the tags out of your clothing. There's all these things you can do to just get rid of any excess. So for me, my big thing is chocolate. I always like to have extra chocolate. I have to have that around. And then I have these two, like, really, really dear friends that live in the UK, and they're two women that I climbed with in China that are very special to me. So I have their picture with me all the time. And so they sent it to me, and they're like, take this with you on every climb you ever go on, so we'll always be together. So I bring that picture with me, and that's kind of my thing that I have with me to, like, keep me motivated and put a smile on my face when things are kind of difficult. So for me, it's just a photo of a couple friends. And I think one more right here. Yes. So the question is, what were the necklaces that the women in Uganda were wearing? So I did give those necklaces to them, and they were necklaces, they just say courage on them. And I got them, I spoke at a conference that Maria Shriver hosted in Southern California, the California Governor's Conference for Women and Families, and she gave each of the speakers that necklace, and I loved it so much that I called the manufacturer and asked them if they would give me some, so. Anyway, thank you so much for being here, you guys, and enjoy the rest of the conference.